RadioInfluence.com.
You know her from network radio, but now she's on the net and in your head.
Don't believe me, just watch.
This is the Fabulous Sports Babe on RadioInfluence.com.
Hey, it's me. I'm the Fabulous Sports Babe. Guess what? It's the podcast. It's my second or third podcast. It's my third podcast already, and I'm still here. That's amazing to me. I've done all of that. We've got things to do today. We'll talk about it in a second. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that football game. I was all ready for football, and I was glad that I saw it, but some of them were just god-awful. Did you see the games? I know you did. Did you see Kansas City? I kind of like Kansas City. And I got to tell you something. I'm tired of hearing about Houston. You had the number one draft choice. You never went out and got anybody. You're still out with this lineman and that lineman, and you know what? You got Bobby Hoyer there now, and whoever you had before sucked. And I don't know why you people cannot get yourself a damn quarterback. And so I have no problem. Okay, Kansas City killed you. Too bad. I don't know what you think is going to happen there, but you got to have a quarterback that's going to run things, and you don't have it at all. In the middle of that, Jets, Cleveland, Jets won that. That was fine. Jets are horrible. I thought to myself, okay, what are you going to do? Even if you have somebody that you think is fairly good and you want to see, you think to yourself, well, I don't even know who the guy is. Who's the guy playing for the Jets? Do we know right now? We don't really, off the top of your head, it's not Geno Smith. You go, wait a minute, what happened? It's Ryan Fitzpatrick. Isn't that who it is? Yeah, Mr. Harvard guy. That's who it is. You know, and I got to tell you one thing. I love the Buffalo thing. Look, Indianapolis is going to win 8,000 games. You know it and I know it, but you had to love Buffalo. You had to love the people there, the Rex Ryan and all the thing, and he is really kind of a pain in the ass. But you know what? I got to tell you, I really did kind of like the fact that Buffalo did well, and they did, I mean, it was good. It was good for them to see it. And Indianapolis going, what the hell happened to us? In the middle of that, what are the things that I see? You know what? Explain to me this. Why is it that people think that Arizona sucks, and yet Carson Palmer is an excellent football player? If he goes down, there's a problem. But he didn't go down till the end of last year, and it's only one game. So, of course, they killed New Orleans. Even if that was a regular New Orleans going to Arizona, I think Arizona still would have beaten them. And now it's a kind of, without Jimmy Graham, we don't know who's really in the backfield, but we think Drew's fine. I'm not really sure about that one at all. What else did I see that I liked a lot of? Ooh, you saw the Dallas thing? I don't want to say anything, but this one said this one did this, and this one did this, and Jennings said this, and Eli said this, and Coughlin, and I don't want to say anything, but what the hell's going on? It's the first game, and nobody knows what's going on. And by the way, did you see Jason Pierre-Paul's, not just one finger, but both fingers? He blew off the thumb, and then they took off the first finger. Well, I don't want to say anything, but if I'm without those two and I'm wearing these three, I'd be slapping that football all day long. I mean, I'd be slapping that hand all day long when nobody could see what's going on for that. That's all right. I don't know. Dallas, I'm getting a little worried about that. Atlanta, Philadelphia was stupid. They were stupid. That's all I can tell you. And Atlanta took care of business in that one. And I'm going to tell you something. San Francisco, Minnesota. I thought Minnesota was going to be a lot better. They're going to be better this week. But I was kind of surprised, which, by the way, do you hate those uniforms? Oh, my God. I felt like we were at, like, Prairie View or something. What was the black? Oh, it looked awful. I thought it was stupid. But I like Minnesota coming up this week because they're going to be home. In San Francisco, okay, you won a game. I'm not buying you too much in the middle of that. So I've gone through all of that. That's what's going on. I don't have to tell you that Tom Brady did very well, of course, against the Pittsburgh Steelers, which are a pretty good team. I have to give you that. But of course they were going to do well. You know, I don't want to say anything, but I could have been the quarterback for the New England Patriots. That place was so, I mean, just so crazy. People were just nuts. It's a good thing they're not in a dome. The thing would have come back and blown the place up. It's a good thing that it just went up in the sky. For all of the stuff that went on there, I don't know about you, but I thought it was fairly good. I liked it. I could have been the quarterback for the Patriots. I'm sure about that. All right, we have things to do. My friend Susan Waldman is going to come today, and we're going to take her right back to where all of this began, way back in time, actually, when I think about WFAN and all the places that we've been since all of that. I'm the Babe. We're taking care of business because I am the Babe. Hey, my friend Susan Waldman joins us on the phone right now. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Do you like being... Are you glad that we're getting to the end of baseball season? We have to put up with this anymore, or are you getting ready to play up?
Well, at this time of the season, you know, it's like when I was in theater, it used to be like being on tour. By the end of the tour, you don't want to see anybody. You don't want to talk to anybody. But they are playing meaningful games in September, which makes it a lot easier. But, you know, you get a little weary. If the team gets to the playoffs, you get a little energized again. But I think the short answer is yes.
Well, you know, one of the things we're going to talk about, because I was going to talk about WFAN, but you need to tell us where you were before you went to WFAN when it first started sports radio in 86.
Oh, I was in theater. I had a whole other career. I did Broadway musicals for years, 15 years, and did nightclubs. And I was getting a little older, and I knew that the theater that I came to New York to do was gone. It wasn't coming back. And I thought, I better find something else to do with my life. And the only other thing that I knew about was sports. And I always, when I was on tour and then when I was home in New York, how I would be close to sports is I would offer myself to sing the national anthem at all over the place. And when I was on tour, I did that. It was before people knew that it was a way to get on television. I just wanted to go to the ball game. And so I would sing the national anthem wherever we were to sort of stay close to this. I've been immersed in sports, not as a vocation, obviously, because you didn't do that, little nice mm-hmm. little girls in the 50s in Boston. So I went. I had my own season ticket at Fenway Park with my grandfather when I was three. And I went to Celtics games, and every Saturday we'd go to Harvard football games and went to the Patriots games when they started in 1960. And it just was part of my life, although I never thought of making it a vocation because I could sing, and that's what I always wanted to do. So as I was getting a little older, I was always around it, and I figured the only other thing I knew was sports. I saw no women doing anything that I thought was remotely competent out there. And it just so happened that a dear friend of mine, the late Ken Coleman, who we were very close friends, and he was the play-by-play announcer for the Red Sox for years, he said to me, you know, I got this friend, his name is John Channon, and he's starting something in New York. It's going to be an all-sports station. They're going to go 24 hours a day. He's got to meet you. And I said, okay, and I knew that I had to get out of theater, so I took a couple of little quick journalism courses to make sure that I knew what I was doing, and I went and I met John Channon, and he said, you have to make a tape, give me a sportscast, and I said, oh, okay. I had no idea what he was talking about, and I said, okay, I'll have it back for you by the end of the weekend. And a friend of mine at CBS FM radio, I went in, he was doing overnights, and we went in, and at 5 o'clock in the morning, I made a mock sportscast and, you know, sort of my smart alecky personality and did scores, and he would interrupt me, and I would interrupt him. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, I put a little cassette tape on the desk of John Channon, and he hired me to do updates. And it's I had no idea what I was doing. I had never done radio before, and I thought, well, this is a good idea. And so that's what I was doing before. I had a whole other career, which means, babe, that I am very old. That's all it means.
Well, let me ask you about that, because when we go through the Broadway and then we start and we begin WFAN, and it's going to start in 86.
87, yeah.
Is that what it is? Because did you do the first thing that started at midnight?
Yep.
And my question is, obviously you're going to talk to George, but were the other people pissed that you were the first one on?
They were pissed about a lot of things, but it had nothing to do with it. It was at 3 o'clock on July 1st, 1987. The radio station was, you know what I remember about that day? And I was the first voice on the air, and I was doing updates. They thought at the time it would be good to have this smart-alecky woman being a foil for the late Pete Franklin, who did not join the station until much later because he had a heart attack and couldn't do it. So there I was doing updates, and this was rip and read days. There were no computers. There was no, you ripped it off the wire. So what you had to write a whole sportscast off of what was on the wire services, and sometimes it was right and sometimes it was wrong. And the first thing I remember two things about that day. I remember looking into the window where the people from WHN were holding hands and crying, because as soon as my voice hit the air, they no longer existed. And that's the picture that I take. On the other side, when I started my first, we are going to have a new venture here, or whatever the heck I said, and I gave the first sports update, I hear the owner of the radio station, who is now my good friend, Jeff Smullyan, who used to own the Seattle Mariners, say, "Get that smart alecky broad with the Boston accent off of my air in prime time." That's the first thing I remember. And the people crying on one hand, Smullyan yelling outside, and Jim Lampley saying to me, "Keep going, just keep going. It'll be okay, just keep going." And that's how I started at WFAN.
You know, when you started there, George had been in some kind of trouble. He was finally allowed back into baseball, and you were the one that had the conversation with him. Now, let me just stop for a minute.
Okay,
it's
that's
five
much
years.
That's much later, but babe. That's much later.
Well, that's even better. I don't even know.
Okay. When I started at FAN, I was just hired to do updates. There were no beat reporters. We had people from the Daily News and the Post on our air talking about the Yankees or talking about the Mets. And because I was getting all kinds of flack about updates, and they didn't want women on at 3 o'clock, it was drive time, I suggested to the then program director, John Pruder, who's now gone, I said, "You know what, why don't we have our own reporters and give me a tape recorder and I'll go out and I'll cover these teams so we don't have to rely on the beat reporters for the Daily News, because they would never give us anything because it was going in the paper." Remember, there were no beat reporters with microphones back then. Right. I was, and he said, "They've never done this." And I said, let me see if I can do this. So they also switched me to the overnights, trying to get me to quit. So, but I would go with my little tape recorders, and I would cover both teams in New York, the Mets and the Yankees. I covered all three hockey teams, because the guys didn't want to drive to Jersey for the Devils. They didn't want to drive to the Islanders. And how I got to do the Yankees was because the other team in town had just won the World Series, and nobody wanted to go to Yankee Stadium. So I said, "I'll do it." Nobody wanted to go cover the Knicks because they had just won 24 games, and they brought in this new guy from Providence. Yeah, I think his name was Patino. Yeah. And nobody wanted to cover the Knicks because they practiced in Westchester. And I said, "I'll do it." And that's how I got the Knicks, because I went there. Nobody wanted to go to Jersey to cover the Nets because it was too far. The guys didn't want it, so they sent the girl. That's how I got to Yankee Stadium, because none of the guys wanted to do it.
You know, one of the things that I think about, is it really been 5 years since George passed away?
Yeah, and I miss him every day.
Tell me about that. I mean, because I wonder sometimes, I guess, to me, you're the first broadcaster that I can think of that's ever done Major League Baseball. And that's what I always think, that you're the one, and other people have tried, but you're the one that's doing it. And yet, how far back did you go with George when you decided to do this? Because you've been doing this for a long time now.
Well, it started in 87 when I first arrived there. And George didn't take me seriously because George had a unique relationship with the writers. When George was around, they all like followed him around like little puppy dogs, and if he wanted to talk, and he was always a presence. And George and I'd say, Mr. Steinbrenner, and I'd chase him down the hall because I didn't want to ask any questions around the writers. Right. So I would chase him down to the elevator, and he'd turn around. When he got in, you weren't allowed to get in the elevator if George was in it. And I would run down, and George would get into the elevator, and he'd say, "What do you want?" as the door was closing. And I'd run up the ramps, and if I could get to the elevator door before he got to the office, he'd talk to me. That's how this started. And I always thought that maybe he waited because he thought it was kind of interesting that some girl was running around and trying to beat all these guys. My relationship with George, as when he started noticing me, was that winter, 88, George always took the beat writers to lunch at Christmas. and I was not invited. And I remember calling the then PR director, Harvey Green, and saying, well, I'm a beat reporter. And he said, no, you're not a writer and you're not a man. And I said, well, I understand that, but I'm a beat reporter. I'm there every single day and I break stories and I should go. And Harvey said, no, Mr. Steinbrenner doesn't want that. So what I did was I wrote a letter and I got the sales department to tell me how much my 5-minute spot sold for at 5 o'clock and how many people listened to my 505 Yankee report. And what I did was I Xeroxed it and I Federal Expressed the letter, and it turned out that not only did my Yankee report sell for a lot of money, more people listened to me at 5:05 talk about the Yankees than read every single paper in the tri-state area. And then I said, and by the way, I'm coming down to Tampa and I demand an interview. I'm taking my tape recorder and I will be there. I didn't tell him I was going to a spa in Tampa.
Right.
And when I got there, my phone, the lighting on my phone hotel was lit up, and it was George's secretary who said, Susan, Mr. Steinbrenner will see you Monday morning at 9 o'clock. And by the way, I have Xeroxed your letter and I have sent it to every woman in this building, and you're going to get some reception when you walk in this door.
Good.
So I walked in and George said, what do you want, Waldman? Now, let me tell you what I think. And I said, okay. And he said, I don't like women in the military. I don't like women in sports. I don't like women policemen. I don't like women firemen. I like women to look pretty and spend my money. And I said, okay, I can do that. Now, I have an interview here. You promised me an interview. Here we go. And if you think that that's all that women can do, I'm really sorry for you. And I took out my tape recorder, and that's how our friendship, mentorship started, because I never backed down from him. I mean, he would yell at me, and I would yell back. No cell phones in those days, right? So you had to call him in the office. You had to call him different places. And about a year later, he had said to me, Waldman, this is 1988, he said, Waldman, one of these days I'm going to make a statement about women in sports. You're it, and I hope you can take it. That was about a year before I had death threats at the stadium, and people tried to fire me, and the people at WFAN were taking my interviews and messing with them so that I sounded like an idiot. That was long after people didn't talk to me in the press box for a solid year. That was after men would send me used condoms in the mail. People would spit at me. Players would spit at me. Yeah, I had a great time. But George, that's what George meant when he said, you're it, and I hope you can take it.
Susan, when we talk about this, and I can put Chris and Mike were the ones that made fun of you when you were talking about the Yankees and about Roger and all that stuff. Didn't they keep running that over and over for some reason?
Well, that was everywhere. That's a lot later, and that's when that was all right. I mean, those kinds of things. The men who are, there isn't one 18-year-old who is an intern at a radio station that doesn't think he knows more than me. They don't, but they think they do. That's the way it is. It's never going to change. And, you know, and I still, after, this is my 29th year with the New York Yankees in some capacity. And so after 30 years, and you know what I'm talking about, after 30 years, my feeling is that I am tolerated in this sports business. I will never be accepted the way the guys are, just for that reason. But it's interesting to see how this has, but now they can't get rid of, when I want to leave is when I walk out the door. That's how that's happened now. But that's okay. And this business is changing too. The way theater has changed, this business is changing also. And, you know, I consider myself now a dinosaur. I don't know how that happened, because I still think I'm 30, but I don't know how that happened. But I am, and I understand that what I think is important and what I think is a story and what I think is important to impart to fans is not something that everybody thinks is important.
You know, one of the things that I wondered about is you have your life, and yet every day for 162 games, spring training, playoffs, every day you have to sit down with John Sterling. And I think to myself, are there days when he hates you and you hate him, or are you just used to it by now?
Well, no, there are days when anybody, as Kurt Gowdy used to say, it's a very small booth, and you have to intrinsically like somebody. Of course you have squabbles, but there are times you say to yourself, you know, I can't do this. And then the game starts and everything is wonderful. Because you get tired, and you're not allowed to do that on the air. You get tired. Sometimes you don't feel well. Sometimes you don't want to be up and lively. But it's entertainment. I consider this being an entertainer, and that's what you have to do. You don't want people shutting off the radio, and
right.
that's being a professional. And I intrinsically like him. He doesn't have a bad bone in his body. Absolutely, John Sterling. He is unique. He is one of a kind, and we have been friends for a very long time. And how I met him was that time when I was doing updates in 1987, and I said that Pete Franklin had a heart attack and couldn't join the station for a few months, they mm-hmm. would have guest hosts in the afternoon for a week, and a week at a time. One time it was Jimmy Pearsall, and one time that first week it was Lampley, a lot of people, and one week it was John Sterling. And that's when I met him, and what I saw at that time was that he spent 4 hours standing up, talking into a microphone, doing his talk show. But we really became friends from that moment. We think alike. We don't live our lives the same, but we have the same references, the Broadway references, the theater references, the literary references, the artistic references. We come from the same place. So it's when someone who has almost your background, the same kind of background, you know to whom you're speaking at all times. And I really like him, and we really like each other. Not to say that, you don't get sick of seeing someone. Of course you do.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I thought about, and I talked a little bit about it, but I think it was 2 years after you got cancer that I mm-hmm. walked around I remember being in my apartment in New York and banging my head against the wall going, am I really going to die? And the person that I had to call was you. Talk to me about when you had, because you had chemo and you had radiation, but you took it on the road.
Oh, sure. Let me tell you, because I was one of those good little girls that did everything right. I was the only one that had preventative biopsies with no cancer, because there was cancer in my family. And they also missed it at the hospital. So if they had done their jobs, I would have had a little radiation. No one ever would have known. But by the time they found it, It was stage 2 breast cancer, and I'm not one of those people that goes, why me? I always say, why not me? And that's what I said when the guy told me about it, when the doctor told me about it. And I called two people. I called my mother, and I called George. And I told him, and that was going to be my first year doing full-time television, a lot. And I said, I promise you, you're not going to not sign me because I've got cancer. And he didn't know what to do. I mean, he said, no, of course not. I said, well, I won't throw up in the booth and I won't appear bald in the booth, I promise you. And he said, Susan, it's going to be fine. My fear, babe, were two things. One, you cannot become your cancer. That's what I knew immediately. I was not going to be one of those people who sat in their house and, if they were a good little girl, could go out to lunch. I fired my first oncologist because he wasn't going to let me go to spring training. Mm-hmm. And I said, get me somebody else. I'm not looking at your face for 6 months. And so I went to the nurse at the hospital that I finally went to, and she said, well, we do have this one doctor. She's very cutting edge. She's from Boston. She went to Dartmouth Medical School. None of the guys like her because she's real cutting edge and she's kind of bitchy. And I said, that's my girl.
That's
get
right.
me her. And we are still friends to this day. And she was unbelievable. And she understood that it was important for me not to become my cancer. And she made me stay home for one chemo treatment, which was in spring training. She wanted to see how fast I recovered. And I said, I can't wait for the blood cells to come up. Give me something to boost it up. So she gave me shots that I gave myself on the road. One, I did not want to become my cancer, and two, I was terrified that if I left, which the guys all wanted me to do, and come back when I was all better, someone was going to be sitting in my chair.
Mm-hmm.
And it was George who made sure there was a refrigerator in my room wherever we were, where I could keep my medicine where I give myself shots. Gene Monahan, who was the trainer at the time, kept. I had my Neupogen in every clubhouse in this country. I mean, everything they'd come, it had to be in ice, and it had to be kept in a refrigerator. They put soda water and saltines on the airplane in case I'd get sick. This was all George, and this was all the Yankees. And it was terrific, and they were great. If I got ill, if I was doing an interview and had to sit down, the player would sit down. And it was never talked about, and I had a lot of support there. Daryl Strawberry used to tell me how beautiful I looked. You know, I had a wig on all the time, and I was throwing up. But, you know, they were terrific to me, that group, and I will never forget that. And that was 96, the year the Yankees won that first group of World Series under Joe Torre. And I was standing with George when the final out was made against the Braves. And we not only did the Yankees win, I remember thinking that I did it. I got through this season. My chemo was over. We've all won. It was the most special year I've ever been through. And isn't it funny that it was the year that I had breast cancer?
You know, one of the things, Susan, and I'll let you go, but do you think, well, I'll be there for a while and then I'll go back to the woods and that'll be it and you'll be over the Yankees after a while? Or you know what I mean?
Will it? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I do. Because that was, or at the moment, I think that. This business is really changing. I once said to myself, I'm not going to leave until there's somebody in a booth that can do this. And it doesn't need to be radio. There is one, and her name is Jessica Mendoza. And when I first saw her on Baseball America, whatever it is on ESPN, I said, there's the one. There she is. She was a little girl when, you know, didn't know me, obviously, but I remember the first television broadcast I did nationally, and it got so much press and so many interviews. And I remember telling Tom Snyder at the time, if you remember him, on an interview, I was sitting in Minneapolis and in one of those and talking to him in New York. And he said, why do you do this? I said, because there's some little girl out there who, because I'm doing this, is never going to know that she can't do this. She's got to be out there. And she was. She didn't know she was, but she was.
You know, one of the things, let me just go through that, because I remember when I was in Seattle and people said to me, if you don't try for that job at ESPN, it'll be 20 years before somebody else does it. And I had a good time in Seattle, and I could have been there, but I knew that inside of me, I had to do that, and I had to fight for that job and do what I had to do. Little did I know it would be a nightmare, but I guess that's part of being a nightmare. But that's what I felt, because I remember people saying to me, if you don't do this, it'll be 20 years before somebody else does.
Right. Well, and you're probably right, because I've been in the radio booth, never mind television. This is my 11th year with John, and it's still just me. And I'm still the only one sitting there, a full-time baseball commentator. And before that, on television, I know women did a game or two. I did a whole season for the Baseball Network. I did whole seasons with MSG and WPIX, and a couple of years they put me on pre and posted. Yes, because they didn't want to, whatever. Well, that was a nightmare too. but we all go through those. But I'm still waiting. I mean, I'm still waiting for somebody else to want to do this and to have the credentials to do this. I know I'm not Vin Scully, but the longer I stay there, the more apt it is for some little girl to think, I can do this. And that's one of the most gratifying things, is to come out of Yankee Stadium, and there are little girls waiting for me, and little girls wanting to talk about that. That's the most, want to do play-by-play on the radio, not television. That's a whole other animal that we can get into another day. But that's what it is, and that's why you stay here, because once I started this job, and probably you feel the same way, if I had started when I was really, really young, I'd be long out of this. I was already 40 when I said my first words on WFAN. So I had already gone through theater, and let me tell you, sports broadcasting makes theater look like nursery school. You see all the backstage movies about theater and movies and all those horror stories. That's nothing compared to what goes on in broadcasting, and you know what I'm talking about. But I think if I were 20, I wouldn't have been able to do it, because once I was middle-aged already when I started, you say, what do you mean no? Don't tell me no. Yeah. And once I went through cancer, what else can you do to me?
Exactly.
What can you do? You know, I've beaten cancer, I can beat you too. And that's really what you have to think. And you also have to, I say to little girls all the time, you have to look in the mirror and say, do you have something that you give that nobody else does? And that's you, babe, and that's why you're still around, and that's me, I must say that. And there are a couple of us around that still do that. Look in the mirror. Don't be the next, you know, Joe Birdbath. Be you. And if there's still no you, there's still nobody out there that's the babe. Nobody. And once I leave, there won't be me. But I hope someone is out there that can do this and keep it going.
I have to tell you something about Susan. If it wasn't for the fact that I knew Susan Waldman, I think that my whole cancer thing would have been maybe a lot different. I was in New York. I was in some of the big hospitals there. And I had this one woman, it's not that hard to figure out where I was in New York, who was going to, like, take off my breast and put a tattoo of my nipple on my boob. And I remember getting up in the middle of this conversation and saying, I got to get the hell out of here. And I walked out. And I thought, this isn't right. I went to other people and they were going to do this and that. And so when I got this cancer idea, they said, yes, you do have cancer. And this was on a Friday when I was going to go back to Florida. And I said, well, that's not going to be happening. Get rid of that town car. And I walked around for like the whole weekend and kind of banged my head against the wall. And I thought to myself, am I going to live here or not? Am I really going to die here? And the one person that I needed to call, because I knew better than anything that she was really the person. And it was Susan, because Susan had had cancer a couple of years before me. And I said, I'm going to this hospital, I'm going to that one. And Susan said to me, you can go whenever you want to. When you're done, we'll go see Dr. Verna. But I have these other people. It doesn't matter. You're going to go see him. That's all that matters. And I did do that. And he was spectacular. He didn't take my boob and go somewhere. That woman who said she was going to put a nipple on my... I was like, doing what? And she said, you're going to go to him because he's spectacular. And he told me that his wife had... what had happened, and she was a doctor too. And anyway, it was just... it was perfect for me. And if it hadn't been for Susan, I don't know what my life would have been like, you know, where it would have gone or how I would have done with it. I wonder sometimes. And I just know that if I hadn't known Susan, I think things would have been very different for me. And I was surprised about that. We'll tell you more about that stuff. Let me do a couple of things. James Blake, they're walking around up there saying, oh, we threw him to the ground. You know what? I don't think so at all. And you guys are going to have to see what's going on there, because of the way that guy treated him, it was absolutely awful. Oh, Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to take over for Donald Trump? What's he going to say? Hasta la vista? Is that what I'm going to say? What's he going to say? Get him in and out before it's all over. And I don't want to say anything, and I've told you this before. I'm in love with American Ninja Warrior. And you can be an American Ninja legend. You can be a ninja legend when you win everything. And they had the big, it took 3 hours, 3 hours from 8 until 11 to see it. And it was the best thing. Why am I so in love? And you know what? I will say that. I'll see somebody and I'll say, you know, I hate to say I'm into America. We watch that all the time. And I went to someplace the other day and I was getting my hair done. And she said, Chris and I watch that all the time. And then I'm talking to these other people and they go, we hear that all the time. We love that. And I thought, well, maybe it's not so awful. Hey, that's my phone ringing. I don't even know that I had a phone. Do I have a phone? I got to go see what's going on my phone. I am the Fabulous Sports Babe.
If you know the babe at all, you know this show never ends.
Don't believe me, just watch.
Follow her on Twitter at Real Sports Babe and subscribe to the show on iTunes. This is the Fabulous Sports Babe on Radio Info.
Hey, sports fans, this is Rich Scherrer. Make sure to tune in to my brand new podcast. It's called Off the Air. We sit down with the biggest names in sports broadcasting, the guys that bring you all the big plays. We're going to turn the microphone off and get to know them off the air. It's Off the Air with Rich Scherrer. Don't forget, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and of course, RadioInfluence.com is our home on the World Wide Web. So make sure to tell all your friends about Off the Air with Rich Scherrer, a weekly podcast featuring the biggest names in broadcasting.